for today's Admissions Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and ultimately successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to the delightful instant when you can high-five the person next to you as you happily inform him or her, yes, I'm in. And not only in, but in at the right program for you. As any of you who have listened to this podcast previously or read just about anything I've written will know, I firmly believe that a graduate education is a means to an end. That implies that before you apply to, much less attend grad school, you should have a desired end in mind. Now, determining that end, that direction, should be based in large part on what you will find satisfying, what you will enjoy, what you find meaningful. But it also has to consider what the marketplace will reward. Graduate education is expensive, and most of us simply can't afford it without expecting some kind of financial payoff. And that's why I'm so excited about our guest today, Lydia Frank of PayScale. PayScale just released the third installment of its annual college salary report, which focuses on graduate degrees. And we're going to be discussing those results in just a second. But first, I'd like to give you a quick reminder. If you have an admissions-related question that you would like me to address, just go to the show notes at info.accepted.com/79 and post your question in a comment on the blog. If your question is chosen, I'll ask and answer it on the show. Alternatively, though the result will be the same, you can also send me questions via email at questions@accepted.com. In either case, you know, whether you do it on the blog or do it via email, I'd be happy to share it here and share, you know, my thoughts on as to an answer. And if you post as a blog comment, that's particularly good. We're getting more and more blog comments and I think developing a supportive, collaborative community at Accepted. So do feel free to comment there, both as to questions you may have or on blog posts. Now, let's dive into our interview today. I'm so excited and pleased to have Lydia Frank on Admissions Straight Talk because I feel that PayScale has developed over the last several years an extraordinarily useful database for college students, young professionals, and graduate students. Lydia earned her bachelor's in journalism from Central Washington University and started her career as a reporter for the Omaha World Herald. By 2000, she was back in Seattle and has since worked at the intersection of journalism and technology with stints as channel manager for MSN, editorial director at About.com, and since 2008 at PayScale, where she is currently the director of editorial and marketing. Lydia, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Thank you so much, Linda. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, great. Now, can you give us a little background about PayScale, the company, and what it does?
Sure. PayScale's been in existence since around 2000, and our founder really started the company to help kind of even the playing field when it came to salary data and negotiation. So, you know, when it comes to what somebody should earn in their career, employers tended to hold all the cards. And even in some salary negotiation advice, it really was, you know, the common advice was that employers should lead the negotiation, and you should just be responding. And, you know, we just felt like it made sense to make sure that salary was a more transparent area and that everyone had access to good data around what earning potential is for different careers. So, you know, it's something we started working on back then with that central goal in mind. But as part of the survey, we've always collected data around education as well, where you attended school, your degree level, major, and that helped us really look at that intersection between educational choices and career outcomes. So that's something we've been doing, you know, for several years now.
Okay, great. And how about the evolution of the College Salary Report, and specifically this year's editions? As I understand it, up until this year, you had reports on undergraduate outcomes, mm-hmm. correct?
Correct, yeah. We first put out some data around alumni earnings in 2008 with the initial installment of the College Salary Report, and we really just focused in on undergraduate education.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, each year we've been able to really expand the list of schools that we were able to look at and drill in deeper on that data to look at majors and, you know, potential career paths for majors and really, you know, broadened the data set that we were looking at. But for a long time now, we've been really hoping to expand even further to the types of schools that we're looking at as well. And so this year, for the first time, we are looking at not only four-year schools, but also we are looking at roughly 352-year schools and also more than 600 graduate schools as well.
So for the two-year schools, you're talking mostly about community colleges and associate degrees, correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay. All right. Now let's go back to, since this podcast is more graduate admissions oriented, let's go back to that part of it, okay? How does PayScale collect this data, and how many responses do you require before including a school or a concentration or a degree program or whatever?
Sure. Well, we have an online ongoing employee survey, so people can come to PayScale.com anytime, fill out a survey telling us about their current job, and, you know, we ask questions about their job role, their employer, their skills, their education, and through that data, we're able to cull that and create this college salary report information. So, you know, that's an ongoing process. We used roughly 1.4 million of those completed surveys to create the college salary report this year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have millions of people coming and filling out the survey every year. So it's great, you know, in terms of how much data we're really able to dig into, which allows us to get past, you know, just the school level and drill into program level as well, which was really helpful. The second part of your question?
The second part of the question was, I think you answered the second part, was how many responses do you require before including concentration?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in terms of kind of individually, we don't look at it as an absolute minimum on sample size. What we really are looking at is confidence level. So we look at both sample size and spread and pay. So for certain fields, the spread and pay is pretty narrow, so you don't necessarily need as large of a sample size to provide a meaningful number.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas certain degree programs where, you know, there's vastly different career choices, the spread and pay can be pretty large, and so we need a larger sample size. But the maximum allowable confidence interval is plus minus 15%, but most of the data falls within a plus minus 10% confidence level. And for larger schools, it can be closer to plus minus 5%. But in terms of average, the average sample size for the included schools in the report is about 325 completed surveys.
Wow.
Alumni.
Now, I'm just wondering, how do you get people or motivate people to fill out these surveys? Is the idea that the people who fill out the surveys have access to more data? Is that how it works?
Yeah, for everybody that completes a survey, they get a free personalized salary report at the end of it. So, you know, if you take the 5 to 10 minutes it takes to give us some pretty in-depth information about your current job, what we can do is tell you how you're being paid comparatively to market.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll look at people who are similar to you in terms of their job, their location, their skill set, their education, and let you know, are you being paid at the 20th percentile, the 50th percentile, the 75th percentile, to really get a good sense of whether you're tapping into your full earning potential.
Do you have anything, like if somebody fills it out and is thinking, well, should I go in this direction or should I go in that direction? In other words, they're not so much looking at, are they paid fairly today? They're looking to tomorrow.
Yeah, we have some different paths through the survey. So if you're more in the kind of job seeker realm or researching other careers that you're interested in, you can fill out the survey, you know, for a job that you don't know very much about and just want to get a better sense of. So, yeah, there's absolutely a way to research careers that aren't your own. We also kind of on the the core website, if you go to payscale.com/research, you can actually look up kind of high-level information about different jobs, also employers. So if you want to get a sense of common jobs at a particular employer, demographics at that company, that kind of thing, that's also available. And you can do that for job title, too. So we'll give you a bit of a job description and, you know, show you some available job listings, give you salary data, you know, typical degrees held by people with that job. There's all sorts of, you know, really in-depth, interesting information per job.
Yeah, like I said, it sounds like an extraordinarily useful database. That's what I said at the beginning of the show, and I'm thinking it as I'm listening to you even more. Now, the salary data that you posted in terms of the college salary report for grad in particular reveal early career and mid-career earnings as well as the percent of high meaning. Can you go through those three terms?
Yeah, so early career, what we're looking at is people that have 0 to 5 years of work experience. For mid-career, it's 10-plus years of work experience. And for job meaning, what we're looking at is people that report a high level of job meaning. So the question that we ask actually is, do you think your job makes the world a better place? And there's kind of a scale, you know, from the low end of no, I think my job makes the world a worse place to the high end of yes, you know, I think my job's contributing positively to the world. So we look at those that answer, I think it's a 5-point scale, and we look at those that answer the top two answers there on that scale.
Okay. And now when you say that early career salary is 0 to 5, I guess it just depends on they report their salary, they're 0 to 5, it goes into that category, and mid-career would be...
Yeah, we look at the median for that sample.
Okay. And just so the listeners know, I want you to realize that this is reported by graduate program. So, for example, I have up on my screen as it happens right now, the top 10, which starts with Harvard Law, then Emory Law, Santa Clara Law, Stanford Graduate School of Business, UCLA Law, and goes down. And you'll see, you know, that's like the different rows, and the columns are school type, early career salary, mid-career salary, and percentage. Let's say it has high meaning. And then you can click through to much, much more data on this. What surprised you most about the graduate results, or did anything surprise you?
You know, I think I'm not sure it surprises us, but it surprises other people sometimes. The schools that top our list occasionally, you know, aren't always at the top of other rankings.
Right.
You know, certainly Harvard being at the top is not surprise, but we certainly had some questions from some law publications and bloggers who are asking about, you know, Santa Clara being so high, that kind of thing.
Pepperdine.
In terms of law schools. And, you know, I think what we, you know, how we really differ from other rankings that exist is that we really are kind of keeping the focus on career outcomes and earning potential, which is a bit of a different lens than reputation, which is often kind of what is going into those other rankings. And, you know, I think it's a different view. So, you know, one thing that we really saw when we dug into why, you know, for example, Santa Clara was near the top of the law school rankings, they have a really strong program in intellectual property law.
Right.
And that's pretty lucrative field. You know, and it applies really across, you know, industries like technology, which is a lucrative field in general, and music, the music industry. And honestly, that program, the IP program at Santa Clara, is even ranked number 4 along with, you know, tied with NYU in U.S. News and World Report's law ranking. So
for IP, right?
Yeah, for IP specifically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, it's when you kind of dig into it a little bit more, it starts to make a bit more sense why, you know, if you really are looking at it by earning potential, that might be, you know, there's a little bit of color there that helps explain why that they might be toward the top.
Right. I know when I basically say that the best thing about the magazine rankings is that they have a certain amount of data there, and that if applicants use them as for the data, it's usually much more valuable than the rankings. And to the extent the rankings are valuable, I think the specialty rankings are more valuable than the overall rankings.
Right.
And again, that requires.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
And that requires, to some extent, that you know the direction you want to take your degree in.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, and I would say, too, we very much, you know, think it makes sense to really do your homework and look at all the data that exists out there.
Sure.
What we know, though, is that data around alumni outcomes is pretty scarce. And so, you know, we don't feel like we're necessarily the place to rank schools on everything you could possibly rank a school on.
Mm-hmm.
But we are, you know, we have a particular expertise in compensation. So, you know, it does make sense for us to try to provide information to students that would be helpful in that regard, which is why we really kind of focus in that area.
That's fantastic. Now, the salary data that you're that you cite on your site is strictly salary. It does not include bonuses or stock options or anything like that. Am I correct or am I wrong on that?
It's actually total cash compensation. It doesn't include stock options, you're correct, but it does include bonuses, you know, if commission, tips, anything that kind of falls in that cash compensation bucket.
All right. What are some of the use cases for the different resources? I mean, it was amazing when I was looking around and clicking around. I mean, you have the list, you have the rankings, you can slice it by majors and careers, you have the visualizations. Can you give us, what if I'm, I got my bachelor's 2 years ago and I'm trying to decide between going into consulting and investment banking, or I know I want to go into consulting. Am I better off going to law school? Am I better off getting an MBA, JD?
Right.
Am I better off going getting the MBA alone? What would you advise me to do if I was in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think you spoke to it really well kind of at the very beginning of this, in that it's so important just to understand the financial implications of your decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's really, really what I think this is most helpful for is to understand the trade-offs there. You know, if you're interested in getting a graduate degree, there are differences certainly between these different programs you're going to be evaluating and their earning potential and also their cost, and also the cost between different schools. And so, you know, if you don't take all of that into account, you could be unpleasantly surprised at the end of your graduate education when, you know, you have a huge amount of debt, and maybe you chose a program in a school that were a little bit, you know, maybe the program is kind of a low earning field and the school was a little bit beyond your means, and you're facing a future of making student loan payments into retirement. What I think this is most helpful for is just really understanding how your educational choices now are going to impact your financial future.
Right. Maybe even what majors to major. And if I've told this story on the show before. Our younger son, when he was about to go into a sophomore year, he called up one day and he was just all tied up in knots. He was basically an easygoing guy, but he was at that point he was just all tied up in knots. He didn't know what to major in. And I said, major in what you like. He says, but, you know, Mom, I got to think about, you know, all someday supporting a family and making a living and, you know, this kind of stuff. And I said, well, you know, you're choosing between accounting, engineering, and I think computer science.
Mm-hmm.
Those are not, you know, you can make a good living in any of those fields.
Yeah.
So you might as well just do what you like. He says, are you, you know, really? And he argued a little bit with me. I said, listen, if you were going to tell me that you were choosing between preschool education and
Engineering.
Right. Yeah. Then I'd say you're making a lifestyle choice, and you have to make that choice with eyes open. But among these three fields, do what you love.
And, exactly.
And I was very gratified a year later. By the way, he went into computers. He's very happy with what he's doing, and he is making a good life. But about a year later, he called me up. He says, you know, a friend of mine is a little younger than I am. He called me up. He says, I'm not sure what major I should major in. And you know what I told him? I said, look, there's no major difference in terms of earning potential of the careers you're looking at. Do what you like. So. He says, I told him exactly.
There you go.
This is music to a parent's ears.
So, I know. Mom's advice was on.
So, but, you know.
Well, I think it's good advice generally, honestly. I mean, even if you were trying to choose between, education and engineering, if education is what you think you'll love doing, there's no reason not to do that.
Exactly.
I think what you need to do, though, is just make sure that you're making smart financial decisions around that. Do you need to go to the most expensive school that you can if that's your plan? Probably not. And it's going to depend, too, about, your family's financial situation. I think it's so important to understand, the real cost to you. Filling out the FAFSA is important, really understanding the net price that you're going to end up paying at these different schools, not the sticker price that's listed.
Right.
And I think a lot of students don't necessarily know that and get, shy away from applying to schools that maybe they actually could afford to go to. They just didn't know that there were, resources or that the school would offset a lot of that cost. And so they didn't bother applying. And I think that's a shame. It's so important to really, do your research, really understand, what the school is going to cost you personally, because it may be that you can go to a really good school and major in education, and not get into an unfortunate situation on the debt front, but you just have to really do that research and not just hope it works out.
Right. No, I couldn't agree with you more. And my daughter, conversely, is in a field where she's working in her field. She has a bachelor's, and she's considered getting a master's, but every time she looks into it, she feels that the cost of the master's will exceed the financial benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And she just doesn't.
Yeah.
She feels that she can progress better in her field as long as she stays in this field just by working.
Yeah, it's hard too. I think it's interesting. My sisters tended to be in the nonprofit world,
right?
And she felt that she couldn't really progress in her career without a master's.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, as we know, you don't tend to make a really fantastic salary in a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
That's also a difficult challenge, I think, in some fields where, the expectation is that you have a graduate degree, yet the pay potential there doesn't match that, So, I don't know what the right decision is there, how to make that work.
Right.
But, I think it's becoming more of a conundrum for folks when tuition is rising at such a rate.
Yeah. Yeah. True. Absolutely true. Now, what about people who want to go into entrepreneurship? Is there anything at PayScale for them, for the self-employed?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, we don't specifically exclude those respondents mm-hmm. from the college salary report. What I would say is, we don't tend to be the resource for entrepreneurs, and I think a lot of that is, especially when you're starting out with a new business, you often are not paying yourself. Our data becomes really powerful when you do have a compensation number that you can share. So it's a little bit tough, I think, in that particular population.
Okay. Yeah, it's also much, much harder to figure out what they're making. I mean, yes, you still have cash compensation, but so many times it's equity appreciation.
Yeah.
What do you see coming down the pike from PayScale and in terms of further refining and adding to the college and now grad survey?
Well, I'd say, you know, we have two kind of major reports we put out every year. We have this one, and now, you know, the graduate data is part of that. We also put out something we call the College Return on Investment Report,
okay.
the College ROI, in the spring. And we haven't done, you know, we're still looking at how we could do this. For graduate schools, the issue has been that, you know, getting cost data for graduate schools is difficult.
Really?
It's varied, and the schools don't have to report costs on graduate schools to the Department of Education in the same way that they do for undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult to come across the data set to use for estimating cost for grad programs, but
mm-hmm.
We definitely are interested in expanding that report as well to include grad schools. We're just trying to figure out the best way to do that. Another thing I would say is, you know, we also just partnered up with a company called CollegeNet, and we put out something called the Social Mobility Index. So we specifically were looking at kind of the low-income population and, you know, how they're progressing through college and into good careers and trying to identify schools that are doing the best job of, you know, helping that low-income population really achieve economic mobility, which is part of the promise of higher education.
Right.
So, you know, that's available now as well. I think the URL for that is socialmobilityindex.org.
If you could send me that link, we'll include it
sure.
in the show notes, okay?
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, the other thing that we've been doing is trying to work with some schools directly to better understand career outcomes and kind of report that data back. So we actually have a pilot program going right now where we're working with a number of schools to survey their alumni directly and then mm-hmm. provide kind of some deeper data analysis around career outcomes to the school so that they can improve, you know, the situation for their graduates in the future as well and really understand how their graduates are succeeding or not in the workforce. So that's really exciting to us too, is how can we really partner with schools to get this data back into their hands and potentially make things better for future generations of students.
Right. I would assume that the schools would be very ambivalent about that data.
You know, they're pretty excited about it,
really?
Honestly.
Okay, that's fantastic.
Yeah, every school that we've talked to, I mean, I think, you know, they've had a challenge getting their hands on this type of data, too, because they'll try to put out alumni surveys, and they sometimes get good response rates, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're trying to do it on their own, or they're doing it through a vendor. But the challenge tends to be that, you know, you maybe get your most successful alumni responding.
Right.
So they're maybe not getting the whole picture, so you kind of have that happy alumni bias. you know, it's just alumni aren't bothering to fill out the survey because they just don't have an extra few minutes to kind of bother with it.
Right.
And the great thing about being able to partner with the schools and use the PayScale survey is that we can offer that same free personalized salary report to all of the alumni who complete the survey. So they actually have a value add there for completing the survey, and they get something back right away,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, we've seen so far has been definitely helping with response rates comparatively to other surveys that the schools have done. So, you know, we think there's a lot of promise there, and I think, you know, the schools that we've been working with and talking to have been really excited about getting their hands on this type of data.
That's great. I'm pleased that they're so committed to the transparency. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I was also wondering, especially if you try and do, like, grad ROI, and I suspect this would be very difficult to incorporate. I mean, mm-hmm. one thing about undergrads and two-year schools is that their earning potential is still very low. But especially mm-hmm. when you're talking about business school, graduate education in general, then you're talking about people for whom the opportunity cost of attending school can be a real factor in terms of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way that you try and calculate that in, or do you just leave that up to the individual user of the survey?
You mean like foregone wages?
Yeah.
Of not working? Yeah,
yeah.
We actually do incorporate that in our college ROI report, even for undergraduate students.
Okay.
So, you know, when we take into account the fact that if you're comparing how much more you're likely to earn by going to school versus starting work right out of high school,
mm-hmm.
we do subtract the, you know, 4 to 6 years of wages that you're not earning into that ROI calculation.
Okay, so then you are doing it. Because I think that
yeah.
sometimes something people don't calculate in, and I think it should be calculated.
Yeah, when we do ROI, basically we're looking at how much more would you earn with a college degree, not just, so it does subtract out that, you know, the earnings that you gave up essentially by going to college.
Okay. Now, you've been an editorial director with PayScale for 7 years now. What advice would you give a young adult trying to balance what they love with what pays?
You know, I think it's similar to what we talked about earlier. You know, I don't think you should make a choice solely based on earning potential.
Mm-hmm.
That's never, you know, how you want to really think about crafting a career and
right.
an occupation and really your life. You know, you spend so much of your life at work. You do want it to be something that you enjoy and that you're passionate about. However, you know, I think it's important to just understand what the earning potential is for whatever career that you're choosing. You know, and really make smart decisions about your education. You know, that if you just do a little bit of that upfront work, it can really help you in terms of which school to attend, how much you can truly afford to borrow, and just keep you from getting into a situation that is going to make your life harder post-graduation. You know, I hate hearing stories about college graduates who are entering the workforce and then end up moving back home because they can't afford to live on their own. You know, we asked a question in our survey for a period of time to look at that particular question, and we're actually coming up with some new data actually in a couple weeks in a generational report we're putting out looking at Gen Y, Gen X, and boomers in the workforce. But part of what we ask of in that report is we asked how many people had had to, or whether people had ever had to move back home after entering the workforce due to financial hardship. And for Gen Y, you know, that number can be pretty startling.
Really?
Last year, we thought it was up around 28% had to move back home at some point, you know, after graduation because they couldn't afford to live on their own. And, you know, sometimes that has to do with underemployment where they, you know, either they can't find a job, so it's unemployment, or they are finding a job, but it's not something that's utilizing their education. So, you know, you have an English major who's working as a barista, and clearly that wasn't the plan. So, you know, there's a number of things that kind of contribute to that, but it's pretty startling, especially when you look at how that compares to other generations. I think for last year, you know, it was 28% of Gen Y had to move back home due to financial hardship. For Gen X, it was only 11%, and for baby boomers, it was only 5% had ever had to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So it certainly was increasing at an alarming rate.
Right, right. And I think certainly with the data that you're providing, the information is out there. You can get it. So sometimes I read, you know, the press reports of the people who have to move home or the
mm-hmm.
young adult who's saddled with $200,000 or $250,000 of debt as a renter and very poor professional prospects because they blew the wad on education. And I think that, you know, it is sad, but it's also unnecessary because I think enough, certainly with the data that you're providing, but it's out there. The information is out there, and they should look at it.
And I think, too, though, I think, you know, some of that falls on parents and kind of secondary education. Like, you know, I truly don't understand why we don't think more about, you know, during middle school and high school, doing more around financial literacy for students
mm-hmm.
and and this type of kind of career planning. Mm-hmm. I think if we encourage students to really think about that, I think that they'd be willing to do it. You know, it's when we don't kind of push it until they're already in school or they're totally, you know, near the end. You know, it's in some ways, like, you know, it's easy to blame the student, but in some ways too, like, no one ever told them, you know, that they needed to really do this. And it can be a shock, you know, it's like if they haven't had to really think about money in any real serious way until they're getting toward the end of college, you know, their college education, it can be a pretty serious wake-up call, you know, if they didn't do this sort of kind of research and planning. And I think it behooves all of us to really encourage young people to get a better grasp on finances in general.
Yes, and we're talking about pretty basic financial concepts when we talk about, you know, return on investment and break-even points and things like that.
Right.
No, I think you're 100% right. My guess is that there's been a certain lag time in that, you know, when baby boomers like myself went to college, the cost was so much lower. I mean,
sure,
you know, when I was going to UCLA, what I paid in quarterly fees, in per quarter fees, mm-hmm. was approximately what I paid in monthly rent. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, the quarterly fees at UCLA probably the equivalent of 3 or 4 months' rent on a similar apartment. So that's an enormous difference in terms of cost of living and impact and all that. And this is a public university. I'm not even talking about the private ones. So I think that's one of the differences. So perhaps the parents of today's students didn't have that conversation because when they were doing it, it wasn't quite as important to have.
But exactly,
You know, I think that your point though is very well taken that, you know, middle school, high school, there should be conversations about, yes, you should do what you love, but you also have to realize that there's a financial reality out there that also has to be considered.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a key point. And I think that PayScale is doing an utterly fantastic job in providing the data and the information that will help people make informed decisions. And that's really what both of us are talking about.
Well, so, thank you. Yes, we're definitely trying to do that.
Well, I think you're doing a great job. Thank you so much for joining me today, Lydia. Where can listeners and potential applicants and young professionals learn more about your work and about what PayScale offers to them?
Yeah, I would say, you know, payscale.com. We generally are linking to some of these special studies like the College Salary Report right from the homepage. You can also, you know, if you are currently employed, you can take the survey straight from there. Most of our resources for consumers are absolutely free to use. So, you know, that's really the place to go.
Okay. We'll include links in the show notes at info.accepted.com/79 to the rankings that I mentioned and to the visualizations, which are also fascinating, of this data on the PayScale site, as well as to payscale.com and things like that. Now, the visualization, just to give you, to attempt to give you an idea of what's being shown, is the increase in salary for different career paths if you started at with a certain major. Am I describing it well, Lydia?
Yeah, it's essentially maturity curves. So, you know, we're looking at for a particular degree level and major how pay increases with years of experience. So we're going from like 0 to 5 years experience up to 20 plus years experience to see how that changes over time. And sometimes the wage growth is fairly flat for particular fields, and sometimes it's pretty dramatic increase. So that's also important to understand is, you know, even if starting salary for particular fields might seem low, sometimes there's some serious earning potential kind of in the future.
Well, that's actually was, I think, what was revealed by Emory and Santa Clara Law in your survey also very, very dramatically there. So anyway, we'll include these links in the show notes. Again, the show notes can be found at info.accepted.com/79. And Lydia, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Linda.
Listener, thank you, too, for joining Lydia Frank and me for our 79th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, please share the good word by leaving a review on iTunes. Your doing so helps us spread the news about Admission Straight Talk, especially if you leave a 5-star feedback. So if you think AST deserves those 5 glittery stars, please let iTunes know. There's a link in the show notes to our iTunes page where you can leave the review. And if you have a question for me, please ask it at info.accepted.com/79 or by sending an email to questions@accepted.com. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.